we're on. Today is Friday, August 6, 2010. My name is Meredith Horn, a graduate student of public history and the intern for an oral history project recording the memories of individuals who have significant association with and knowledge of IUPUI. Funding comes from the University Library, the Department of History's Public History Program, and the University Administration's 40th Anniversary Fund, administered through the IUPUI Office of Community Relations. Today I am interviewing Robert Halter, who began as a student in 1971, graduated in 1974, was a food buyer and educator, and is currently Director of Purchasing at IUPUI. We are in the television studio in Kavanaugh Hall on the IUPUI campus, where we are recording using both digital audio and digital video. Robert Halter, thank you for agreeing to this interview. I would like to ask your permission to do the following: to record this interview in both digital audio and digital video, to have the interview transcribed, to place the interview and transcriptions in the IUPUI Special Collections and Archives for the use of patrons, and to deposit the video with the IUPUI Office of Community Relations for such public relations purposes as the officials in that office deem appropriate. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay. Then to begin, I would like to start with a question about your youth and your educational background. So just to begin, where were you born?
Vincennes, Indiana, August 1948.
And who were your parents?
Lawrence and Shyla Halter.
What did they do?
They're farmers, and still are. The farm was established in 1837.
Oh, wow.
In Vincennes. Of course, that's about nearly seven or eight generations ago. And they still live on the farm, but my brother owns it now and farms it. 13 family members make a living on the farm.
Were you the first to leave the farm then?
No. Families were fairly large. I had five brothers and sisters, but one sister and her family and one brother and his family work on a farm now.
Wow. Where did you go to high school?
Well, I went to high school at two places, St. Minard Minor Seminary in southern Indiana, and I finished my senior year at Central Catholic in Vincennes.
Were you active in school?
Well, actually, at the minor seminary, I wasn't so much. In the regular biology club and the bridge club and hiking group. But when I left the minor seminary and went to Central Catholic, I found that our studies were fairly well advanced. So consequently, I was able to test out of a lot of courses, which gave me a lot of free time.
Yeah.
And I became very active. So I became president of the CYO, I became president of the student council, president of the senior class, I was editor of the yearbook, so I was chairman for the homecoming. Just, wow. I had the time.
Yeah, you were very active then.
So I was able to do it.
Wow. So
fortunate.
When did you graduate high school?
1966.
1966. And where did you first go to college?
I went to Vincennes University for 2 years, 66 through 68.
Why only 2 years?
Well, it's a two-year college.
Two-year college.
Right.
And did you do business at Vincennes?
Right, business, and marketing.
And then why did you come to IUPUI?
Well, my wife and I were living in Florida, and she wanted to come back to Indiana. So she wanted to come to Indianapolis because there was a job opportunity. So she left before me and got settled here. So then I followed, and we ended up in Indianapolis where we had some friends. And that was in really early summer, like May or June of 71. And I took a job at Sears Roebuck downtown store, which is now O'Malley's full-time, and some people there were going to school at IUPUI and talked me into going back to school and coming to work full-time, or excuse me, coming to school full-time and working part-time. And they also worked for the bursar and during the registrations, So that was my first experience with IUPUI, was coming here in mid-August, maybe just nearly 39 years almost to the day, and working the first registration that was held in Cavanaugh Hall and the lecture hall. The long lines twisting around the building and out in the courtyard.
Yeah, can you describe more about registration?
Registration was pretty hectic.
Yeah.
We were trying to register as many people as we could through these two buildings. So they would come in that east entrance of Cavanaugh Hall and go around the core. There would be different stops for them where they would do things, get their classes, etc. Then they would walk out the back door, the south door, and across the courtyard and into the lecture hall. And that's where we validated information. You know, at that time, we were dealing with paper, or really 5x7 cards. And we would validate what was written, and the stuff was inputted that night, the information, and then reports, batch reporting was done. But we would take their money, and very little credit cards at that time.
Yeah.
The university wasn't really taking credit cards. It was either cash or check. So it could be a very long wait because you'd go around that core. Then we took the cash down to the central part of the lecture hall. People don't know it, but there's a round room down at the bottom.
Oh.
And that's where we counted the money. And registration would start about 9, although people would line up much, much earlier, as if they were trying to get tickets to a Jimmy Buffett
concert. Got you a concert or something,
you know.
Yeah.
And we would wrap up about 11 that night. But this was the main registration. Then after that, we would go out to the various schools. So for the medical school, we would go over to Fessler Hall and set up in our lobby. For Heron, we would go there. For 38th Street to pick up other students, we would go there. So we tried to branch out, and we had our little money boxes. They were little gray boxes and little cash boxes, and we had change and, of course, cash so that we could take transactions. And we didn't have police protection going and doing when we did our little surveys around. Everybody was interested in getting registered. Awful lot of comments about why am I going to IUPUI, you know, that
yeah.
type of thing, because IUPUI was still a new concept, only been around a couple of years, and people were still adapting to the fact that IUPUI was a significant university, and that's where they should go. There was about 13,000 students about that time in 71.
Mm-hmm.
And so that began my relationship with IUPUI. And I got to meet a lot of people, business administrators at the university, faculty and staff, and of course students. I made a lot of friends because the paper information I'm talking about was really like a 5x8 card.
Mm-hmm.
And on that, not only did you have personal information, which we would never do today,
yeah.
but the personal information would be everything from where you graduated, what your favorite studies were, hobbies were,
mm-hmm.
nicknames, things like that. So you just meet people. People come up, they give you your card because you're checking it for information, and you see their name is John,
mm-hmm.
and they call him Johnny or whatever, and they remember you because you helped them. We also helped ourselves sometimes where we would expedite our
yeah.
request and go through the line. And we could do that. People will frown if they look at this audio, I suppose. But there was a lot of student workers who had a lot of friends who we could get through the line. And back in those days, once again, administration would very much frown on this, but the classes were so open that there was really, it was easy enough for people to get in a class.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of sections of classes, but sometimes the most favorite class would get closed off, and then the student workers could just open it back up.
Really?
And add people.
Ugh.
And the thought was not everybody would come. So if the limit was 40 people in
mm-hmm.
class, and you signed up 46 or 48, maybe 39 would show.
Yeah.
And But rather than being turned away, you could help some people. There was a lot of help going on with that. Registration was certainly an exciting time of the summer. And even, I did that for my 3 years as a student, every fall, every spring, and summer. When I became an administrator with the university, they continued to loan me out to the bursar and registrar's office for about 5 years.
Really?
And we were continuing to do registration this way until they became more electronic, where you could register online and that. Those were different days.
Yeah. Yeah, the computer isn't quite as forgiving, I think, about registration.
No. There was a lot of hand-put information, and you had to be careful a check was written out correctly, and you didn't take a check that was going to bounce because it wasn't written or signed. I think a surprising thing about it was very, very few parents.
Really?
Parents didn't come with their children because they weren't children.
Yeah.
The average age of the students was in the, I would say, upper 20s. And many of them were married. Actually, what you ended up with was sometimes a parent with a child carrying the child in her arms, and she's registering to go to class.
Wow.
I think the ratio back then was maybe like 60% of the people were full-time employed who were students at the university, and they were going part-time. Not all married, of course, but a great number of them were married. We had a lot of husbands and wives who were going to school and alternated their classes so that one could babysit while the other one, and they might babysit on campus.
Were you working full-time at Sears?
I was really classified as part-time, but they could use me to fill in wherever they needed me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was getting my 40 hours a week in, but that meant I was working Saturdays and Sundays. Of course, I was on commission selling appliances, vacuum cleaners, washers and dryers, carpet and furniture, and TVs. I went through every department.
Wow.
And so I made enough money to have a living on. I wasn't very lucky to have any scholarships or anything, but because of my grades in high school, the state at that time was giving some scholarships or stipends, as they called them, for mm-hmm. being in your upper 10% of your class. It was $200. That's all you got.
Wow.
So I was on work study. I worked a lot, as you can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent my work study time at different departments, library, law school, med science building, and laboratories, cleaning. LaRue Carter, working with the young, LaRue Carter was young people there, and disturbed kids, and working with them and everything. So going camping with them, which meant we couldn't leave the grounds, but they could put up a tent inside the fenced off area.
Oh, really?
They just didn't have to, they weren't in their rooms, so to speak.
What kind of work did you do then with them?
At LaRue Carter?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had different, different classes that were, or workshops, art, crafts, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you, as a student, I just kind of worked with them and, helped them out with their little project, that type of thing. It was as much as anything to be a moderator, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
Just somebody in the room to make sure things didn't get out of hand.
Yeah.
So, interesting.
Yeah, interesting work. So what else did you do as a student at IUPUI? What other activities?
Well, at IUPUI, when you came to class, you ended up staying if your next class was, say, a couple hours. And when I worked at Sears, I would generally work in the morning, or I'd work in the evening, and I'd work on weekends. So you had time, and if you had people in your class you got to know and you needed to work on a project or a group, then you would try to find a place. And those students that I became acquainted with were active in many different things. I did a lot in high school, hadn't intended to do much at the university because I had done so much. But the people that I was running around with here were working on the Sagamore, so I worked on the Sagamore newspaper, was a reporter, would go and take some pictures at times.
What were your stories?
Oh, it was just some of the things about what was happening, or you take a picture of a car that's parked on top of a fire hydrant or something, you know, just the odd stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not a prolific writer. But I think the interesting part about that is that with the Sagamore, we would get together, and as a group, there'd be maybe 8 or 10 of us that would get together and bounce around different stories, because not all of them could be included. So you got to listen and critique, and you learn from that.
Was that a large group of you?
No, about 8 or 10 of us that did that part of it. The Sagamore office at that time had already moved to the Cavanaugh Hall building downstairs in the basement, and we had a rec room next door to it where there was a pool table and that, so you could get up and go and shoot pool and
have some fun.
Yeah, that's right. And it was fun. It was hard work.
Yeah.
But it was fun. I did that for about a year. We also were trying to form a student government at that time, our student senate. So we became involved in that. I ran for an office of student senator and was elected. And one of our first chores was to write the bylaws for the student senate, which we did. I know they've been amended many times since then, and maybe even been discarded and rewritten altogether, but we wrote the original version. We'd hold our meetings over in the lecture hall, and they'd last sometimes very long because you had people from all over campus, many student senators representing different departments or divisions,
mm-hmm.
and they just came with different perspectives, like somebody from hyper physical education or that would certainly feel different than somebody from business. And
what were some of the concerns that students had?
Well, I have to think back on this as to what's... There was very little funding for student activities. There just wasn't any money.
Yeah.
At that time, I don't even recall that a student activity fee was being applied. And then when they did finally apply one, I think it was maybe just $1, maybe $2. Another thing was always the contentious relationship with Bloomington, because some of the professors were driving up from Bloomington and teaching, and they would make their views known and that. You know, people were very defensive of IUPUI.
Really?
I mean...
It came out in the classroom? Like
yeah,
that?
It would come out occasionally. And, you know, people were proud of IUPUI, but a lot of people didn't know about IUPUI,
right.
How it came together and the story behind it and what the future goals were, what people were thinking administrative-wise. There was a lot of disorganization on the campus. It had only been merged together for 2 years.
Yeah.
And Maynard Heim was... And the faculty council were trying to make a goal of it, you know, but they were still feeling their way through because they were having to start from scratch on some things.
Right.
And then your blending of the IU and Purdue faculties together and taking classes, you know, here I'm on the IU program, but I'm going up to 38th Street to take classes on the Purdue side.
Oh, you had classes on both sides.
Right.
Mm.
Well, things like psychology were more of a
the sciences.
Science
mm-hmm.
on the Purdue side. So that was an issue always. Another thing was, of course, parking. People were always upset about
that
parking.
That hasn't changed at all, yeah.
No. In 39 years,
it hasn't changed at all.
Actually, we did have it a lot more convenient back then than they
really?
Do now. We could just about park anywhere and get away with it. Hmm. You know, you had your permits and stuff like that, but there wasn't nearly the enforcement as there is today. And if you did get a ticket, because it was all paper and that, you know, it might take them, you might be out of school by the time they
figured out that you
got it all figured out.
Yeah.
But you think about Kavanaugh Hall and the library and the engineering and technology building, the SPIA business building, and that courtyard in between, where engineering and technology is, and the SPIA business building were a couple houses and then just empty vacant land. And all this area out here that's now green space was parking. But most of it was parking, just gravel parking. So you could park and walk right in the door.
That would be nice.
In many cases, there was, and very early on that was the case before they started putting sod down, and then you could park across the street. If you had a break in between the classes, you could walk down to the corner of Blackford and New York, which is just two blocks down.
Mm-hmm.
There's a liquor store. So that was easy enough, you know. There were a lot of things. A little cafe was on campus. I can't remember the name of it right now, but over at Barnhill and Michigan.
So there were places to go and spend time on.
There were places
campus.
To go. Union Building was kind of too far away.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't feel like walking that far. You didn't feel like you had enough time to go there. And so you just didn't. But there weren't that many places to go. When you hung out, you were really limited. You went to the library. The Hideaway was in the basement of the library, and that was usually very busy.
The Hideaway, could you talk about that?
That was a little cafeteria that was being operated by the university. And
was the food good?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes. It was a combination of hot food as well as sandwiches, a deli type, and of course you could get your beverages.
Was it expensive?
I don't recall that they were very expensive, but I can't be sure of that. One of the things that the university has always done is try to provide food service, but we've always had limitations on what we could do, where it would go. But surprisingly, vending is very popular on campus. Vending in mainly beverages, but snacks and we used to have ice cream machines and all this before. And food, sandwich machines, everything. Vending was very, very big. Actually, vending on this campus was larger than Bloomington.
Really?
Significantly larger than Bloomington.
Do you think that was because most students were sort of in transit and not living on campus?
They would leave their job, come here, grab something from the vending machine and, you know, snack a bit or have something to drink in class. Or then you would take your sandwich, you could take them in class. There wasn't too much enforcement at that time.
Yeah.
So food was available, but again, we didn't have 30,000 students on campus at the time. Far, far fewer. And you were able to get what you needed. They would stay open till maybe as late as 9 o'clock at night. So, see, classes ran very late. They still run late.
Mm-hmm.
But classes would go as late as 11 o'clock at night.
Was that common then, to have later classes?
There were quite a few.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that every class had a 9 to 11 o'clock section, but there were some of the more popular classes that did.
To 11 o'clock?
To 11 o'clock.
Wow.
11 p.m.
Wow.
And then you had some weekend classes, the weekend college that Jim East put into place many, many years ago in the 80s. And so you could go to class on the weekends. And you could go to class at Glendale Mall, and you could go to class at Ben Davis. I think Ben Davis High School was one of the areas.
So classes were really located all
everywhere.
Over. Everywhere. Everywhere, yeah.
Everywhere. We were. As a young campus, we were flung about. I forget. I think somebody once said we had as many as 10 or 15 locations where we were offering classes on a regular basis. And people would be able to get there a little easier because it was closer to them, and maybe it was a class they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But we were strung out. Heron School of Art on 16th Street, you know, School of Physical Education was up on 64th Street. You had, the Marab building up on North Meridian. You had facilities on Delaware, facilities on Michigan Street.
Did you ever have a problem getting between classes?
Not really, because I was fortunate enough, because of my connections, to schedule my classes at the times that were the most convenient for me. Without going into more detail, but
yeah.
You get the drift. But so I was able to book them closer together. If I did have to drive, like go up to 38th Street, that'd generally be an evening class.
So what were your faculty like?
They were really nice.
Yeah.
And intelligent, great.
And you said a lot came from IU Bloomington, or they were visiting?
No. There was a share of them that
did.
In fact, I think there was a share of them that came from Purdue, teaching over in the School of Engineering and Technology,
right.
in the later years.
Mm-hmm.
That building was built maybe in 75. Of course, they were offering the classes up 38th Street.
Right.
The thing I appreciated, which a lot of people criticize, are the part-time adjunct faculty.
Mm-hmm.
I think they brought an awful lot to the classroom. And we as students sitting there, a little bit older than some high school kid who's just starting,
mm-hmm.
could appreciate that these people were out making a living and they were bringing their work with them, their experiences with them to the classroom. And that meant a lot to me. I remember an attorney was teaching a business law course. I remember the human resources course I took was taught by the director of HR for the state of Indiana. I remember a tax law course that I took that was taught by an IRS agent.
Wow.
That's the breadth of the adjunct faculty. In fact, even myself, I was teaching as an adjunct faculty for 16 years in my earlier career. And I was teaching purchasing. Of course, that was my career. And when I was ready for class, I would scoop up a lot of papers that were on my desk and simply carry them in my briefcase to the classroom. Projects I was working on, RFPs, RFQs, talk about specifications, talk about responses, expectations, maybe do an analysis, and walk through it with the students. Real life things.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, even some of the questions they asked caused me to make a decision perhaps differently than I would have been looking at some things on face value. But that's how I taught, and that's how a lot of the professors who taught me operated too.
What was downtown Indianapolis like when you were a student? Was it?
I didn't spend much time downtown.
No.
But it was dead. It wasn't near the lively downtown that it is now. Oh, let's see, you had the Point, that's a pub there on near Sears, and it's still there and doing well, and the other pubs on Massachusetts, and then you had Elbow Room. And
yeah, I've been there.
Really, the places that students were frequenting, and keep in mind, many of them went home because they had families.
Yeah.
But they would hang out. There was two or three places up on near Talbot, on Talbot, and on North Meridian, like the Stouffer's Hotel,
yeah.
which is no longer there.
Yeah.
And it had a lounge, a pub, and we would go there. As when I was on the debate team, that was another thing that I did was help form the debate team under Dr. David Burns, and. We would go there to practice. Of course, we were drinking beer, and that's one of the advantages of being an older student, you could drink.
Yeah.
And but we would go there, and there's a couple of other bars and hangouts. They used to be near 22nd Meridian and all this. I can't remember the names of them right now, or 25th Meridian, up near the Marat Center, I think
yeah.
they call it. But they were unique. Maybe hangouts like you used to see on Friends.
Yeah.
Hangouts like that. that just casual gathering places. But we didn't really have anything here. You had Working Man's Friend. You've heard of it, maybe. It's just down here on Harding Street. And that would be for a lot of locals would go there, and a lot of staff would go there to have a cheeseburger or something. It's kind of a very plain Jane local pub. But by and large, the average student when I was going to college was fully employed or working part-time at the very least. And if they didn't have a family, they probably had a wife. And it just didn't go out and party. You did what you needed to do.
You didn't have a lot of extra time to do anything.
No,
else. Yeah.
That's why there weren't a lot. First of all, IUPUI did not lend itself to a lot of evening things. We just didn't have the organization for that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you even think about it today, yes, we do have opportunities, but not necessarily like you would on a major campus like Bloomington or Purdue or Ball State. So a whole different environment. It is an urban campus.
Yeah.
And people came to get their work done, meaning going to class, do their studies, get the degree, and hopefully get a promotion or get a job.
Do you think it helped you to get your degree to be employed like that? Did it help motivate you?
Well, it did.
Mm-hmm.
I've always had a pretty strong work ethic, and it just kept me busy. I could work, I could study at work sometimes when it was slow, and it helped me, I think.
Yeah. Now you said that you helped start the debate team, right?
Yeah.
What was it like to start a club like that?
Oh, we didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah.
We didn't know what we were in for. Dr. Burns was a wonderful man, he put us through the drills, of course. I can't even remember the topics we were debating at the time. I want to say one of them was the abolishment of nuclear weapons or something. You know, again, you're in the early 70s. The Vietnam War is still going on.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of...
Heavy topics.
And people who might be drafted and just a lot of things. So we didn't know what we were doing. He guided us through it. I can remember a debate at Butler. I can't remember the topic, but I remember going to Butler, and we went up there. We all met each other out in the parking lot. Are you ready? You know, are you there? Because when you went to a debate, you might have three or four teams of debaters, and then you go into different rooms, and you take the pro or the con, whatever you're assigned.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't know what we would be assigned. So you couldn't prepare heavily one versus lighter on another. And we didn't do the best in the world. We didn't do the best. But it was a well worthwhile experience. And Dr. Burns was proud of us, and he said we did good. Actually, the best that we did was at Rose Hall, and I remember going there.
Really?
And we didn't win it. But I think out of maybe eight teams, we came in third. That was the best we ever did do.
Wow.
So, of course, the debate course is only one semester unless you want to kind of continue on and on and on. And so you're in it quick, fast. You experience it, and you kind of move on. But there should be a picture. There should be somewhere. You have a group of us with our names below it. I looked for it once in the archives, and it's not there.
Yeah.
But I remember it being taken.
Wow. So did you feel at a disadvantage to schools that had students that lived on campus and that were able to spend more time in groups?
Excuse me. Not having experienced it, I wasn't able to relate.
Mm.
When I went to Vincennes University, I commuted to school. My first class was at 9 o'clock, but my job started at 5 a.m. I was unloading trucks, semi-trucks, and I would work for 3 hours unloading semi-trucks by hand, 40,000 pounds, canned goods, number 10 cans of green beans and baked beans and corn and whatever else.
Wow.
And then I would go to school.
So you were wide awake by the time you got to that first class.
Wide awake. And then go to class and then come home and work on the farm.
It's a long day.
Long days. So living on campus, I think, would be a great experience, mm-hmm. but I never had that luxury of doing that. And I never really spoke to very many people who did. The people who were coming here mm-hmm. generally had not transferred here. The ones that I knew had not transferred here from, say, a residence campus mm-hmm. like Ball State or IU or Purdue. They were living in town, had always lived in town, had their own apartment. Some lived at home, but it was their intent, their choice to come. So disadvantage, I would say, no. The alumni office would tell you there is.
Yeah.
Because you don't get involved and you don't get enveloped in the campus life, and you don't forge that relationship with your campus like you do if you're living on campus.
Yeah, it's not home as much.
It's not your second home.
Yeah.
That's right. The university was really a place of business. I mean, you came and you conducted business. If you were fortunate enough to be able to do some of the other things like I was, mm-hmm. and I didn't do everything, I just did some, you were lucky. Employers were very benevolent. Employers would let their employees off in the middle of the day to take a particular class, but they might have to skip their lunch hour to do it. Mm. But they would let them leave and come back late and maybe not even make up the time. I know I talked to several people that were that way, because the people wanted an education, and IUPUI was the place to get that education.
So as your career as a student was sort of winding down, you were finishing your degree, what did you see yourself doing? Did you want to stay in Indianapolis and stay working?
No, my first choice was to leave. I was divorced at that time. Mm-hmm. And so my first choice was to, I'll put this. My first choice was to get a good job.
Yeah.
Whether that was in Indianapolis or elsewhere wasn't as material because I'd already lived out of state.
Yeah.
And I thought I had a job lined up. The economy was not good in 74.
Right, yeah.
And actually Richard Nixon froze jobs hiring for the federal government because I had an interview with the IRS and had thought that that would be a career that I might follow, and actually it would have been in Atlanta, Georgia.
Wow.
But everything got frozen, and so there was no job. So I graduated with a 3.2 or 3.25 average or whatever, you know, which mm-hmm. was just okay
yeah.
on a 4-point scale. And I had no job.
That's
so
scary.
I just set up a produce market because we raise produce on the farm. Huge farmer's market down here by Eli Lilly, or there used to be.
Really?
In Indianapolis Farmer's Market. And we would truck produce up to that market. Other neighbors and farmers would truck produce up to that market. So I bought a pickup. Actually, I bought a pickup and an old milk truck. And I would go down and get produce, and then I would sit up on the corner of Millersville Road and Keystone and sell produce. That's what I did that summer.
Did you like it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, when I was in college, I would go home. One year, I went home during the summer. I never took summer classes. I would either work full-time at O'Malley's, or one summer I went home and worked on the farm because my father was very ill and my mother needed me to come back because my oldest brother, so to speak, was not old enough to really carry it. And we opened up a produce market at that time.
So you had experience.
38 years ago. So we had always grown produce, but we had never sold it retail. And so we kind of got the feel for it and everything then. So they didn't need me to come home to the farm, and I because my older brother was a couple years older then, mm-hmm. or my younger brother was a couple years older. And so I thought, I'm going to open up the market here and then keep looking for a job. But I can make money on the market.
Yeah.
And I could work at Sears too. So that's what I did. And that I started in about the 1st of July. And then I date this based on my date of employment with the university, which was August 19th of 74, which was a Monday. Somewhere around a Wednesday or a Thursday prior to that, mm-hmm. the bursar of Purdue University, which was on 38th Street, Barbara McQueen came to my stand and said, "We've been trying to reach you." Of course, that was not the day of cell phones.
And you were emailing and all
right.
that, yeah.
If you're not home, and if you don't have voicemail or an answering machine, it's hard to catch people. But she said, "We've been trying to reach you because there's a job available in the purchasing department at IUPUI that we think you would be ideal for." Hmm. And we've been talking to some people, and they will meet with you when you can meet with them. And so I said, "Well, I'm very much interested, but I have a produce stand to run." And she said, "Well, go make a phone call and see if you can get an interview for tomorrow." And that was like the Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
But tomorrow would have been that Thursday. And so I did, and got an appointment, and I came back, and I said, "I still got all this produce, which I'm gonna lose." And she said, "We'll run the stand for you." So she and her assistant came to the market about an hour before I was to go downtown. And they said, "Just to come as you were, don't get dressed up, just come. We know who you are."
Yeah.
And so I went downtown.
Do you remember what you were wearing?
I was a t-shirt and jeans.
And jeans, yeah.
And I came downtown and I met with the director of purchasing, Bob Neal, and he said, "I've heard a lot about you, and I have a position, and I need to fill very quickly." So we talked a while, and my experience is similar to what we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "I want you to meet a couple of other people." So we walked across campus, and I already knew the business manager, Art Lotzenheiser, for the campus, so I said hello to him. And once again, I was very casual. And but I was clean.
That's good.
So I forget, can't remember who else we met at that time, but then we walked back to purchasing, and Bob Neal said, "Can you come back tomorrow, but dress up tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I can do that." So I came back the next day, and Mrs. McQueen and her assistant again ran my stand for me. This was a Friday. We got in the car and we drove to Bloomington. Well, I had a shirt and a tie on. And
had you been to Bloomington prior to this?
I had never been to Bloomington before then. So we went down there to the director of purchasing and a couple of other people. I met them and they asked me a few questions and all that. So in the car on the way back home, Bob Neal says, "Well, I want to offer you the job. Are you interested?" I said, "Well, yeah.
Yeah."
And he says, "When can you start?" And I said, "Well, I have a produce stand."
Can't forget about the produce stand.
And I said, "I've got to sell all my produce." Excuse me. "Or I'll lose a lot of money." And he says, "Well, how's Monday?" Of course, I couldn't have started on that Friday, and they didn't need me on Saturday and Sunday, and I said, "I can deal with that."
Yeah.
So I showed up on Monday, and I closed my stand-up, is what it amounted to, mm-hmm. for the rest of that summer. And that's how I got my job. Then we didn't really talk about money, but it was $4.50 an hour. That's what I started at, which I think might have been close to minimum wage at that time.
Yeah.
And I was what they call an exempt employee, meaning you only got paid once a month.
Oh.
And, that's hard. And you weren't eligible for overtime.
Oh, wow. That's difficult. Yeah.
No overtime.
Wow.
I became the food buyer. So my relationship was, I knew what the size of cans were because I unloaded all those trucks in a food warehouse. And I knew different manufacturers, and I had a farming background. I was familiar with fresh produce, and I was familiar with poultry and meat and other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a personality that they needed because the person before me, they had terminated. I came to find out. They just couldn't get along with people. They were not a people person, and they were looking for a people person that they could train.
Do you think that's why your name came up to be
so.
Able to?
I think so. So my biggest customers were the administration, the food service administration at the student union building that managed the hideaway, and then the hospitals, nutrition and dietetics. And the dietitians were a tough group.
Really?
Very tough group. But they taught me a lot.
Yeah.
I had the business at CUME, and they had the subject matter expertise. So
Were they very large then at that time?
Well, University Hospital was open,
mm-hmm.
and the cafeteria there was very large, and they were still making things from scratch.
Oh.
And then the Riley Hospital, we were operating out of Riley Hospital. We were also operating in Long Hospital. It was still open. And then, of course, the Union Building had a couple of satellites. And the Union Building itself was still very, very popular.
Was your office in the Union Building?
No, my office was in the PX Building, which stood for Purchasing Building, which was at the corner of Blackford and New York. It was an old building that had been a manufacturing type of building, and they had a lot of heavy wire in there. So the floors were like 3 foot thick to support the weight.
Oh, yeah.
And it was 4 stories tall. And I had a little cubbyhole office. They have a picture of me taken not too long after I started with a mustache, and I was a younger Jerry Bebko. And then in 75 we opened a child care center,
mm-hmm.
or close to then,
mm-hmm.
and that was in the Mary Cable Building. We had just acquired that building.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with the Mary Cable Building.
No, I'm not.
It was at the corner of Blackford and Michigan. It was an old public school. We took it over, and I forget how many kids Beth Jaglom, who opened it up, had, but she must have had 100 because it was a lot of stuff we had to get. And nutrition and dietetics worked with providing the food and the beverages and the snacks for the kids. And at that time, we had a food stores in an old warehouse. Which was the old Hostess Bakery warehouse, which was on New York Street, because this used to be an industrial section of town.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where the track and field is now.
Right, yeah.
That's where it was at. And we had trucks to make deliveries, and so what we did was we used one of our trucks to go pick up the food and the snacks and take them to the child care center. So we would do that, and we worked it out. So my job evolved in that I started out as a food buyer, but when they came upon projects that they didn't have a particular person who had an expertise on doing something,
mm-hmm.
then I got it. I was the go-to catch-all person.
What kind of jobs did they give you?
Well, I officially maintained my connections with the student services. So I would meet with student organizations and the deans for student services and the organizers, the Mike Wagners and the Miriam Langstons, some names you probably recognize, and the Jim East, and people whom I already knew, and I was able to maintain those relationships and hang out with them sometimes during the workday. Of course, nutrition dietetics took a lot of time, but then they had certain catering functions they needed help with, so I might just go out in an evening and help them with the catering thing.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff like that, or a student union building the same way. Then, as of course, I was teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into the teaching part because the chairman of the Restaurant Hotel Institutional Management Department, which was this Purdue school, had a heart attack. And the class was purchasing, focused more on food purchasing. So they came to me and asked me to fill in. It was a daytime class, so they gave me an exemption and let me leave my office and go over there and teach that class. And that's how I got started in that and continued for 16 years, even after he came back.
Were your students mainly then adults as well?
Yes, there were some younger ones. Of course, today it's tourism and management has changed quite a bit. So I was doing that. I worked with the other purchasing managers because I began to manage. We had central delivery for the campus at the time.
Could you describe what that is for everybody?
Well, that's where all deliveries would come into one location. They'd be checked, and then they'd be reloaded on a university truck, and then re-delivered on campus. And so I became the director of the stores and the director of central delivery.
Where was that? Where were the stores located?
That was at 1410 Stadium Drive, or what we now call Indiana Avenue. The building is still there.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a very large facility, I would assume?
So it's 40,000 square feet. Fairly good size.
Yeah.
We had loading docks and that. Oh, one area that I became quite familiar with was physical plant. And the purchasing manager that was buying things for physical plant became ill and needed to leave an absence. And so I kind of filled in and picked up some responsibilities at the time.
Seems like there's a lot of illness.
Well, we had a large department then.
Yeah.
We had like 30-some people.
Mm.
And so when you have that many people, of course, the purchasing managers were older. I was the youngest one of the group.
Oh.
I was a junior everything. That was another reason why they gave it to me to do.
Some new blood?
Pardon?
Some new blood in the system?
Right. And... And because they didn't want to do it. So and that was back in the 80s.
This is prior to Chancellor Bebko. This is the early 80s?
This was being mid-80s.
Mid-80s, okay.
Chancellor Bebko came, I think, in about maybe 86.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
See, Maynard Hine was the chancellor when I came as a student.
Mm-hmm.
And then Glenn Irwin came, maybe about the time I started working for the university.
Yeah, probably around, yeah.
Around 75, maybe, or
yeah,
70.
Because Chancellor Hine was not chancellor for a very long time, considering
right.
how long Chancellor Bebko was there. And how,
right.
Yeah.
So, and Chancellor Hine had an office in an old dry cleaner's. Which was at, there's an intersection of, I think they call it Beauty Avenue and Michigan Street, and on the point was an old dry cleaners.
Mm-hmm.
And the university took that building over, and he put his administrative offices in there. Just phenomenal. But that was the university.
Yeah.
We took old buildings and repurposed them. And because that was what was around us. There was no money to build new buildings.
Yeah.
They wanted new buildings. But that money was hard to come by, and once again, IUPUI wasn't recognized as being the campus where funds ought to be directed.
Mm-hmm.
You had the School of Medicine and the Dental School, but the other schools were still fledglings and trying to get off the ground.
Now, you said you interviewed in Bloomington, and that was your first time going to Bloomington.
Yeah.
Did you make many more trips to Bloomington, or did you see that a lot?
Well, it's an odd thing that the tensions between IUPUI and Bloomington were kind of stressful at times.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I started with purchasing, we dealt with paper requisitions mm-hmm. that would have to come to us through the campus mail. No fax machines, no email. And they would show up, and if that order was under $1,000, then you as a purchasing manager could approve it and work with it. And then you still had to bundle them up and send them by courier every day down to Bloomington to central purchasing, and they would review your work.
Oh.
And then they would send them back, and then we would type them in like 8 copies, you know, the 8 carbon copy paper.
Oh, okay, yep.
And distribute them, and the yellow copy goes here, and the blue goes there, and the green goes there, and everything else. And so that always irritated the devil out of us.
Yeah.
That they would look over our shoulders and question us because they don't understand the situation. And they don't understand, or they didn't understand the immediacy of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we really fought that, and eventually we were able to wrestle that control away from them, because John Ryan was the president of the university in my early years, and then Tom Ehrlich came. I think it was Tom Ehrlich after Ryan, but somewhere around in there, Indianapolis became recognized as a core campus.
Right.
On an equal basis with Bloomington.
Right.
At that time, they began to cut some cords, very reluctantly, but we began to gain independence. Always a connection, but still some autonomy, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that was very refreshing and very welcome, because that meant we didn't have to send stuff by courier then, and we would just do our things. We had a internal audit department from Bloomington that was stationed on campus, and they were over in the old barracks, and of course we were subject to audit at any time, but we got to know them and everything, so we were very, very flexible, and we established good relationships, so we didn't mess up.
Okay, we'll take a short break here.
Okay.
And we're back. We had been talking about the relationship with IU Bloomington and tensions, and how in 1974, I believe it was, Indianapolis was named a core campus, and so IUPUI got a little bit more independence than they previously
right.
had. Is there anything else you'd like to add about that relationship?
Well, as a student, I think we were always rebellious about the Bloomington oversight. And we really did want some independence. There were some students who were more focused on that than others, mainly because they had more time on their hands than they could be, I guess. But there's always been the rivalry. It's still there today.
Yeah.
It hasn't gone away. But IUPUI is a different type of campus. It always has been. A lot of free thinking, a lot of resourcefulness. We're going to get it done. Let's just make it happen. And when I went over to the business side of it, it became so much more obvious to me. The students were not organized. We really weren't organized. We had a student senate, but we didn't have volumes of voters behind us.
Right.
You know, we were just trying to forge our way along. And we didn't know what that path should be in one way. On the business side of it then, it became more evident. And you would talk to people who were just chafing because somebody in Bloomington wanted to have control of this program or that program or whatever, and they'd be upset about it.
Yeah.
Or some memo would come out of Bloomington that we needed to do things in this way or that way, and that would upset people. So as we grew larger, we grew stronger, and of course our budgets became bigger, and we could do more things. We had more buildings, and we were able to chart our own course, and people began to really adopt the philosophy that we were going to be the greatest, the best urban university in the country, and that even when compared to our peers, we still stood apart because we were two great universities on one campus, not taking away anything from the other two universities, but we were unique.
Yeah.
We were unique. We were the child or the acorn that fell not too far from the tree. It is now growing to be its own tree, larger than the other two. So that was people's goals, to be the best. And because of that, our resourcefulness really showed through. I could see the temperament on campus. When you had a new idea, people didn't push back at you.
Yeah.
Unless they were a 40-year employee, maybe. Who might have. You know, and a lot of employees transferred up here from Bloomington.
Really?
So they brought, I mean, over the years, because mm-hmm, it was mm-hmm. an Indiana University campus.
Right.
It wasn't IUPUI. And so they would have some of the carryover, the baggage of the old.
Tradition.
Yeah, the tradition type thing. And so, but for the most part, people were willing to listen to new ideas and ways of doing things. And so, as a university, IUPUI was able to move forward, I think, a little bit more quick step. We had our central delivery and our central stores. And in the 80s, when I took over directorship of them, there was a trend being developed in the industry, primarily in the automotive industry, about what they call just-in-time delivery. So that goods and services were delivered at the moment you needed them, or in a short time frame before you needed them, maybe the day of, the morning, you need them in the afternoon, or the day before. And we just didn't feel it was cost-effective to continue to run our operation, because in order to run it, we had to buy it at one cost. We had to put a markup on it, which was less than we buy it in larger quantities, put a markup on it, sell it to the departments in order to support our electric needs mm-hmm. and fuel and stuff like that. But we kept inching up close to what the cost would be if the department had bought it direct.
Oh, yeah.
But the model for universities has always been, and still is, at many universities, of central receiving, central stores, central delivery. So it was in the, I think it was like 89 or 88 that we closed them. We just closed them. And we told people, we told the vendors that you're going to deliver direct. Well, they were used to doing it with all their other customers.
Yeah.
And so that happened.
Was that a decision that was made then by the chancellor and the department purchasing?
No, actually, the chancellor wasn't involved. He was probably aware of it, mm-hmm. but it wasn't discussed with him. This would have been Jerry Bebko.
Right, yeah.
Bob Martin was the director of administrative affairs, and Dave, can't think of his last name, was the director of finance at that time. But we made the decision, and so we closed them. And it was really phenomenal, because we cut out all these costs, and our prices actually went down. So it was great, and service was improved.
Really?
And service was improved. So we're talking about probably at that time was maybe a $2 million enterprise, which was fairly good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, altogether on goods and services, IUPUI spends about $200 million. But a lot of that is services, not goods.
So.
The direction then, I gave that as an illustration that people were willing to work with it.
Mm-hmm.
The largest change in my career came with the introduction of technology, electronic ordering, and email. And back in those days, that was in 1987, July 1. And we moved from our PX building to our offices currently in the Union building,
mm-hmm.
and we adopted technology. We had what they called the dumb terminals at the time, which meant you had a server or something like that, and all you had was a keyboard, basically, that you were working off of, and you were all hooked into it, and they did batch processing and all that, but then orders could be printed out, and we still had to mail them.
Was it difficult for the department to turn to computers and to shift to the way they were doing things?
Well, it was more difficult for people like me and the purchasing managers because we were relying upon our assistants to do all our typing.
Oh.
So we weren't typists.
Mm.
And we had to learn. And
was that a fast process for you to learn to type?
No, it was a laborious process.
Yeah.
But I had fortunately had typing in my senior class in high school. It was a class I took. I couldn't test out of it. So I was a little bit a step ahead of the next person. And the change to technology just turned our world around.
Really?
Just things were cut down time-wise from start to end of a process. Just phenomenally. What was days, I should say weeks, turned into days. And then as we got smarter at it and with better technology over the years, it's turned into hours, and hours have turned into minutes. So that today we can track the introduction of a requisition into our Epic purchasing system, and it's timed, dated and timed, who approved it, when it's approved, when it moved on to the next person, etc. And then it gets to purchasing, and when we touch it, and when we execute it, what we do with it. So that if I'm talking to somebody on the phone, and there's an emergency that we need to take care of, like the one I did just less than 45 minutes before I walked over here, I had a hazardous waste situation in Kokomo. And I said, look, folks, I got to leave at 1:30. And they had to have this done today to start the project on Monday. So while I'm on the phone, the department enters the requisition. I had the contract, it was scanned in and sent to me. The vendor is on the phone. So we're going over a 3-page contract, reviewing indemnification rules or language. And I'm doing some scratching and editing, and then I'm adding some stuff, and the requisition comes. The requisition is processed by my assistant, sent to me for approval, all while I'm on the phone. Then the documents, I sign the documents, I scan them back in, and it's done.
Wow.
So that they can do this emergency asbestos removal project first thing Monday morning in Kokomo.
That's amazing.
That's what we've gone to. When we moved to our facilities and introduced technology, we had 32 people in our department. So that was order typists, expediting clerks, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Today we have 12. In those days, we processed about 40,000 orders and about $60 million. So there was a lot of orders for small goods. And today, We processed 240 million, 100,000 orders, and we do it with 12 people.
Wow.
So that's how much we've progressed.
That, and not in a very long period of time. I mean,
well, 1987 to now is 20 years, but it's, and we did it all through attrition.
Yeah.
You know, people retiring, we didn't replace them, we just adopted or adapted and went on. But that's how I view IUPUI. That's, we just adapted and we moved on.
Yeah.
And we're in the Mary Cable building teaching classes, and you know, we've got lighting problems or something like that. We got to take care of them because the next class starts and physical plant would go over and take care of it, and maybe they need supplies and we get them the supplies, and life goes on. And the students were there, the students, I can remember that we would have, when we first built the steps out here to the east of the University College building now, the old library. I can remember classes being taught out there. I didn't teach a class out there, but I can remember classes being taught out there. People would just move outside. And but we had poor HVAC in a lot of buildings.
Yeah.
But we took old buildings and we converted rooms in tunnel areas, underground areas. There's a maze of tunnels that run through the campus on the north of Michigan Street.
Really?
That connect the buildings.
I didn't know that.
They're not accessible to the public anymore, but we used to wheel patients through them, supplies. In the wintertime, there's steam pipes that run through those tunnels and electrical and gas and water. But you could walk from one side of campus to the other without having to put a coat on in the middle of the winter.
Well, that would be really nice.
It really would. It'd be nice to do it now.
Yeah.
Of course, the concept today, which was originated back in 75 or 74, is the overhead gurgle tubes,
yeah,
which are not heated or cooled, as you know.
Yeah.
So there was always the promise of a new building, and we did have a lot of new buildings. And they were academic buildings, they were research buildings, parking garages, which we needed a lot of, because more people on campus. And it just evolved. We grew, our footprint grew, and then we bring more divisions down to campus. I can't recall exactly when we moved all of 38th Street down here, but I don't think we got them all down here until the late 80s, maybe, or...
Yeah, I don't know when all the buildings were moved, but I know it was Chancellor Irwin's plan, and then Chancellor Bebko took it on right away, that in 1986 that was an immediate plan to centralize.
So maybe it was the 90s before we got the last one down here. But that was the thrust. The master plan, which I still have a copy of, about so big by so big, and it's all in color and everything, and it shows these fancy walkways in the buildings. And
yeah.
Some came about, some didn't.
Did you have input then into, no.
No, we didn't. Today, they have a master plan development and people can give input. And as you know, there's a master plan that was recently done within the last couple years, looking out 20 years towards growth.
Right.
And changes, and if it comes about, that would be great. I remember one thing, talking about an issue as a student. I know I'm digressing here, but we campaigned for a student center.
Really?
We never got a student center.
Yeah.
We were promised a student center.
It came eventually.
Yeah, in what, 2008?
Yeah.
Well, when IUPUI to open its doors officially as IUPUI, the original intent was there was to be four buildings here to make up this central cluster.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth building was a student center.
Oh.
And it was out there where the green space is. That's where it was supposed to be.
Oh.
But it never happened because they ran out of money. And they continued to not have money from 1969 until 2008.
Wow.
That's how long it took to to get a student center. We have a fabulous student center.
It really is, yeah.
But it took a long time to get that. Many other projects are still, I think, on the drawing board.
Yeah.
What they might want to do to reconfigure traffic, pedestrian movement on campus, how we take care of parking.
Parking. Yeah.
We need a lot more garages to accommodate. And now with the new Wishart Hospital and everything going on, it's going to cut down. It has already cut down on a few thousand spaces, a couple thousand.
Yeah, they sent out mass email about
right.
Be careful, get your
I'm sorry, I got off topic. You were asking.
Well, you just moved to the Union Building, and
just moved to the Union Building.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
So, can you talk a little bit about your new responsibilities and what the campus looked like in your Union Building? You said you had a small office before and a cubby.
Yes, I really did. Then I moved into a larger office. The space that we moved into in the Union Building was former student housing. And had a single, what they called single student dorms over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were large. But we did double up. There was two of us to a space. So the 208 square feet per room, which was designed for two students. And so we put two staff people in those rooms. So it'd be about 100 square feet per staff person. And, but we had a lot of staff.
Yeah.
So eventually, as we downsized staff-wise, then we were able to spread out a little bit and people got more privacy. And so now today it's one person per 200 square feet.
That's nice, yeah.
And soon the Union Building will be torn down. And another page will turn, and we'll be moving. We do not know where yet.
Oh, you don't?
No, we don't know where, but we'll be moving. The Union Building has a lot of mixed memories for me, particularly because I did spend a lot of time there in my job as food buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And I maintained my food buying responsibilities from the first day of my career right up till now. Although it's changed significantly because we don't prepare our own food
mm-hmm.
anymore. We have Chartwell's and the hospitals belong to Clarion.
Right.
So in 97, when they became Clarion, my food responsibilities there went away. But we still have what we call hospitality and different things with student services, and I still work with them with housing. So, and help them out with their things.
Now, in the pre-interview, you had talked about getting married in the Union Building, right? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Okay. Well, as I said earlier, I was divorced, and I was a student. And then I met a lot of people, and I developed a friendship, and which evolved into a relationship, getting married
mm-hmm.
to a girl, Barbara, who was Barbara Meyer, who was the dietitian in charge of food service for the Student Union Building.
Okay.
Of course, my job meant I needed to have a lot of time with her because I was in charge of buying what her needs were.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, she had a lot of catering that she did also. So I would go with her on catering functions and stuff like that and help her out. Of course, I got to eat too.
That's always good, yeah.
That was some of my free time. And our relationship developed and we decided to get married. And she did not want to go back home to her little town and get married in a little church because her friends, she thought or felt, were here at IUPUI.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got married in the Union Building, in the cafeteria. It wasn't remodeled at the time. The floor was all one level. But the employees decorated it up and even got some colored paper or plastic or transparencies in that. And they made cathedral-type windows that they put up in the large glass windows and drew the curtains back and all this. It was really nice. And so Barbara went, you know, got changed and everything. If you've ever been to the Union Building, it's a cafeteria line.
Mm-hmm.
It was at that time. So you'd walk one entrance through the cafeteria and then you go out into the open space, much like maybe an MCL or something. They were really separated. So her entrance was through the cafeteria line, which she stopped and got a, I think a Mountain Dew at the time. So there was an aisle and all that. So then we had the reception upstairs, and we had about, nearly 200 guests, all employees and friends and family, and it went into the evening. But so that was the experience there.
That's
very
amazing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It was the only wedding, to our knowledge, that had ever been performed in the Union Building. There have been many romances in the Union Building,
yeah.
Sure. Which reminds me of another story, if you don't mind.
Oh, yeah. Love stories.
As part of the 40th anniversary celebration, we had, about this time last year, an open campus tour. And we invited former alumni and students to come back to the campus and to meet us at the campus center. And we arranged for buses to take people around, and we had golf carts and stuff like that. And there was a group of us who volunteered to be the tour guides. And so a couple walks in, and they were, I would say, in their late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a very good judge of age. I don't remember their name right now, but we do have it on record. And we also had these golf carts that we could, two-seated, you know, two seats in the back, or a seat in the back, a seat in the front.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to go on a tour on the golf cart, and I said I would take them.
Yeah.
So we started out, and we had two tours. One would be maybe the south side of campus, because you had two different types of students. Those who had experiences south of Michigan Street.
Yeah.
And those who might have had the experience with the School of Medicine and Nursing north of Michigan Street. So we divided our tours up that
Did
way.
You ever have the Purdue campus people that wanted to go to 38th Street?
Well, even if they did, there's no buildings there.
Okay.
There's nothing they could do. So this couple said, well, we'd like to do the whole thing. And I said, well, okay, we can do that. So we started out, and they just sat back there and really enjoying themselves. And it turns out he was a dentist, and she was a radiologist.
Uh-huh.
Well, we go down, and they start talking about they were here in the 50s.
Oh,
and
wow.
The Union Building was built in 52. So it was very new then.
Yeah.
And they just started talking about it, you know, and sharing. They had not been back to campus for 30 or 40 years.
Wow, it had changed a lot,
and
yeah.
It had changed a lot. So then as we meandered through campus, and I took them student housing and all this, just totally amazed. And so they said, can we go by the Union Building? And I said, yes. So we went out in the parking lot, and I said, you need to take a good look at it, because it isn't going to be here. And they said, well, let us tell you a story.
Oh, boy.
So as a student, he was going to dental school, and he lived in the Union Building.
Hmm.
She, as a radiology student, lived in what we call the student barracks. These are old World War II barracks that were existing where the Riley Outpatient Center garage exists today.
Oh.
And they were old barracks.
Yeah.
Well, the Student Union Building was very popular. I mean, popular to the extent that people from the city came there in the evening to have dinner. course, I'm not saying we had a lot of first-class restaurants in town either, but it was a place to go. And they had great Sunday brunches and buffets, very well known for that. Well, this gentleman had spotted her at different times in the ice cream shop at the Union Building. And it was still there for many years, even after I came and was working.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't get closed down, but I don't know, 15 years ago or 20 years ago. And he spotted her, but he was bashful and didn't know how to approach her. Well, they come to find out that she had a friend who was a girlfriend of a friend of his. So they made an arrangement to where he could meet her in the ice cream shop at midnight, just before closing time. So the four of them met and they became friends, lifelong friends, as it now turns out.
Wow.
And they would then meet for ice cream. Well, you know, fraternizing on campus, particularly in somebody else's room, was not very well looked on in the early 50s. And his room looked out towards the east. Her room in the barracks looked out towards the west. He could tell when she was in her room, and she could tell when he was in his room. And so they did a little light signal thing. You know, it reminded me of the Paul Revere thing, one by
land,
two by sea, so they could, when they're wanted to see each other, because they didn't have phones, they would like send light signals like the Navy ships do, you know, blink the lights a few times. And then they would meet, and where they would meet is outside the east entrance of the Union Building, and you go around the corner, and there's a little stairwell there that's just, you can't see it because of all the brush, and that's where they would meet.
Oh.
And that's how, and that's part of their story. Now, the other thing is their dates would be at the Working Man's Friend, that pub I was telling you about, and that they would have to walk there, which was a pretty good hike.
Yeah.
And in order to take her on a date, he was working, he worked at Wishart in the emergency room, but he would go out and sell blood to get money to take
to
her
to
Working Man's Friend, and he would literally tell her, "You're drinking my blood."
Oh.
They did not want to go in the Union Building because it was all shut off, the swimming pool, everything was closed down. They did not want to go in. They just wanted to sit there and look at it. And we walked, we drove around the front on the grass and everything, drove around to their little hangout.
Yeah.
And but that was one of the most rewarding experiences for me, to spend probably 2.5 hours with them that day and hear their stories.
That's amazing.
It really is. It's a connection going back, just as I now am a connection going forward and going back. So it really impacted me that day.
Wow.
So, sorry to get off topic.
No, that's okay. That's really amazing. And the Union Building, to have such significance, and now it's going to be taken down and make room for more growth, more expansion.
Yeah, well, the Union Building will be turned into green space.
Green space.
Yeah, the office that will replace it will be across the street in the parking lot.
Oh, I've parked there many times.
Yeah,
I guess so I won't
be. Just across the street and be a professional building, all to support Wishart.
Oh, I see.
So, but we've lost many buildings that way.
Yeah.
Turned into parking lots, or we lost many trees because of parking lots and asphalt and stuff like that. We really are a lot of asphalt and cement.
Yeah.
Not so much green space.
Yeah.
The Glick Building took out a lot of space now, but we're getting off subject. Sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Now, in 1997, you became the director of purchasing.
I did.
How did that happen? How did you get that position?
excuse me, well, I was the associate director of purchasing in 1991.
Right.
And that was through a retirement of Rosalie McQueen,
mm-hmm.
who had been, had a 44-year history with the university, retired. And I became the associate director. In 1997, Jim Wilson, who was 5 years younger, older than I was,
mm-hmm.
Died of a heart attack. And so they replaced Jim. And that was kind of an odd story in itself. By that time, in 1997, I already had, 25 years, or however many years here,
mm-hmm.
knew a lot of people again. And the traditional way, the normal way of doing it is you put together a search and screening committee, you advertise a position nationally, and then you sort through the resumes and you interview people and make a selection, and it's done by committee. So they started to go through the process. This is a story I'm told because I was not part of the process, obviously, as a candidate. And they formed a committee. They came together to talk about what they were going to do. The committee sat around the table with a mixture of faculty, researchers, and staff, and how they would go about it. And the discussion began, well, we can do this and we can do that. And then one person said, well, our candidate is in-house, Rob Halter. And they said, yes, all we're going to do is go through the motions.
Oh.
Because our candidate is Rob Halter. And they decided at that time that I was their choice. So they did not advertise it. They did not interview. They didn't go through any motions. They just came together, made a decision, and the job was offered me. And yes, I was interested in it, so I took it. So then 1997 till today, I've been the director of purchasing, until February 1, I've been the director of purchasing for IUPUI. In February of 2010, we have reorganized the purchasing department of all the campuses of Indiana University, and now I'm the executive director of procurement for Indiana University for what we call the northern area, which is Indianapolis, Kokomo, South Bend, and Gary. I have a counterpart for the southern area, which she's in charge of Bloomington, New Albany, and Richmond. So my staff of 12 is now a staff of 21, because I've inherited quite a few people and more responsibility. So now I'm executive director of procurement for the system.
So you've sort of come full circle from being under IU Bloomington to gaining independence
now
to coming
I'm
back.
Very much. Yeah, our accounts have changed. I'm now university administration, so I have gone the whole circle. The whole circle.
So in 1997, when you became director of purchasing, what were your new responsibilities and duties?
Well, Jim Wilson, respectfully, came from the military, and he was a lieutenant colonel in logistics. So logistics in the military is procurement.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And our relationship was that he didn't take on very many projects.
Oh.
He was retired from the military, so he was in retirement mode,
yeah.
so to speak. He came to the university on September 26, 1974, 7 days after I started. So I had 7 days seniority on him. But he came as an assistant director and I just came as a junior buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so our relationship from 1991 through 97 was that I was doing a lot, more than what an associate director would normally do.
Yeah.
I was handling the projects. Even to the extent that when the merger of the university hospitals with Methodist to form Clarion came about, I was the only one on the Indiana University side who sat at the table and negotiated with how we were going to transition different services, operations.
The director wasn't there. It was
it was me.
Wow.
And it wasn't anybody from Bloomington. It was me.
Wow.
I did not work with the HR side of it. I just worked with the logistical side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't work with the facility side of it, buildings, because that wasn't my thing to do. So when I became director, I was pretty well prepped for the job, if you want to say, or schooled. My responsibilities changed to the extent that when I would go to meetings that I hadn't gone to before, you know, as a director, that Jim had gone to, but basically my work responsibility and my workload did not change. I just kind of moved on.
New title, but
new title.
Same duties.
New title.
Wow. So, reading some of the notes you gave me here, I kind of want to go back in time
That's
a little
fine.
Bit and talk about when we got the new library and the usefulness of the new library, and you mentioned here some break areas and in Kavanaugh and also study areas in the library. So a little bit about that.
Well, the new library was, what, 93, 92,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara
Fischler. Mm-hmm.
Was the head librarian, very much a taskmaster. Oh, was she a taskmaster. And the library was her crown jewel, so I can't blame her.
Yeah.
Well, the other projects that other people don't take on,
yeah,
that I'd always been
your odd jobs,
with,
yeah.
That became part of what I was doing, was to be her liaison and to work with things. So we had purchasing managers who knew to buy the technology and who bought the furniture and who did stuff like that. But I ended up being her logistics person, or the logistics person for the department, and trying to make sure it all meshed together and manage the different orders and the projects and stuff like that. And then we had to move. We had to move from the university college building, or the old library,
mm-hmm.
into the new one. And so we came up with this idea. And the idea was that we wanted to involve as many faculty and staff, students, as we possibly could. So as long as they felt like doing it, before they got tired, we had the people form a relay line, and they snaked in and out of the building, and they started at a stack and handed a book that handed a book that handed a book.
Oh, wow.
And that went on for about 4 or 5 hours, and then people kind of petered out, and then we turned it over to the professionals. But everybody got a kick out of it.
Yeah,
they got a big kick out of it. And there's a lot of pictures floating around, I think, of that
I've seen
day,
those, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Of that day, and I helped arrange that. That was one of my logistics things to work with. But it was not my idea. I just helped facilitate it.
So you got a lot of participation then to have enough people
to...
We did.
We had a lot of participation. But the line started stretching out after.
Yeah.
After everybody got their picture taken. They
yeah.
Thought, well, I'm done. I'm
yeah,
out here.
That was fun, but yeah.
Then, then University College, we had to take the racks out and, you know, and get it situated for classrooms, or mainly offices, basically. And there was a lot of renovation there. And Scott Evanbeck can probably tell you the story on that much and he probably already has much better than I. So, but the new library was a tremendous step forward that put us in a digital age that people would say we hadn't been in before.
Yeah.
And how people could make reservations online. As far as the study areas were concerned, you hung out where you had a place to hang out. You weren't bashful about walking into a building, and if they had a lounge, you plopped down. And you did that. There weren't too many odd chairs around, or, you know, we didn't have like the we call them the learning spaces, mm-hmm. you know, over in this business via area.
Scott Evanbeck was telling us about how they thoughtfully have tried to put nooks and crannies around so that students actually have a place to just plop down.
Yeah, and we didn't have those. We didn't have a conference center across the street.
Right. Yeah.
There were some old buildings. You could go over to the university hospital and sit in the cafeteria, but very few people went to the hospital. They just didn't feel like going over there. It was the medical side, so to speak. And you didn't tramp over to the Union Building either. So you went to bars. That's where you hung out.
And you're old enough to, so you
Yeah. Most of us were old enough to. Or you went to somebody's house. I suppose on a residential campus, people will go to each other's rooms.
Yep.
I don't know. But here you go to your houses. I can remember that, in fact, she's has her own business now. Her name is Grace Worley. If you've ever seen it in the paper, she's a financial counselor. But her husband's name was Scott. And we would go to their house to study. I can't remember the particular subject at the time, maybe sociology or whatever. But they also redid furniture, reupholstered, and that. So we might be sitting in their warehouse on somebody else's sofa that's in a half state of being reupholstered or updated and studying. But that's what you did. That's where you went. I think it was a good experience. And then people would, you know, go your way, go home.
Just coming into my memory now, in the pre-interview you had mentioned a class, I believe, that you had taken that was sort of a love each other, take care of each other class. Was that?
That was Jim East.
Jim East, yeah.
And he was the associate or dean of students for liberal arts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I'm okay, you're okay.
That's it, I'm okay,
you're okay. I'm okay, you're okay. And it was for student leaders. And what he was trying to do was to establish a cohesiveness among the student leaders so that we could work together to try to build a foundation. I mean, we were, because we came from such various backgrounds, we all didn't stay in a dorm, we didn't live even in the same apartment complex or anything. And so, it was coming together at the times you were on campus. And he taught this class. And he was really good about it. And he was able to just, they still teach similar classes today, which is to recognize differences. You know, diversity is
diversity training. Yeah.
Yeah, diversity training is a recognition of each other's differences and an acceptance of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the early stage of that in the 70s. And of course, back in those days, we had again the Vietnam War. We had a black student union, that type of thing. We had just gone through the 80s. Rough years of riots and stuff like that and everything. So you're right, it wasn't to learn to love each other as much to accept each other and recognize it and that, but we would get together at lunchtime normally and then discuss it. And it served me well, I think, over the years. And John Wilde, who was a fellow classmate, he sometimes credits me with having helped him as a study partner get through some of these classes. But he was part of that group too. And he became the executive director for the Missouri Student Loan Program. So he's since retired. But that was an example of a different experience, I guess.
Yeah, unique experience.
There was a lot of opportunity for additional help.
Yeah.
If you needed it, like with algebra, some of the math courses. The professors were very willing to stay a little longer or have some office hours and have a group of you just crowd in an office and do something. I'm sure there's still some of that that goes on today, but a lot of times things are more structured nowadays. You go online and you're doing, you know, long distance, so to speak. But back then, you got together. Unfortunately, once you had that class and you left the building, you know.
Yep.
You didn't go back to your dorm or have dinner together.
Yeah.
Unless there was a reason you needed to study something.
Yep.
Or a test.
Now in your notes here, you also have written, I found that there were two sets of expectations when dealing with the medical side versus the liberal arts side. And you put, both had high expectations of service, but the medical side demanded it and the liberal arts simply expected it.
Yeah.
But both were high maintenance.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the researchers on the medical side have extremely high standards. They still do. And they're driven people. They want to cure cancer. They want to solve, you know, other problems that we have, health problems. They have very limited time and limited resources, and they're impatient if you're perceived as an impediment in their process to achieve their goal. So if they want something, listen, it's 1 o'clock, how come it's not here?
Yeah.
You know, I just called you at 12:45. Why haven't you taken care of it?
You've had 15 whole minutes.
You haven't returned my call. Very demanding in that respect. So you begin to develop a quick response. I mean, it just was the expectation that was demanded that you provide that service. It was the customer service that was drilled into us in administration, that you provided and you provided and you provided. And the medical people, by golly, that's the way it was going to be. Now, on the other liberal arts business side and everything, the expectation was you're going to provide them the level of service. They don't have to demand it. You're just going to do it. And if they need it by 5 o'clock the next day and they're talking to you at 5 o'clock today, they don't call you at 9 a.m. in the morning like the medical people might be and say, have you taken care of it yet?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have it. They won't call you till it's 5 o'clock and it hasn't arrived.
Yeah.
So it's just an expectation. Many friends on the medical side and many friends everywhere else, because I've dealt with many of them over the years, many of whom retired and who continue the ranks of the original people that were here in 1969, and I wasn't one of them, but continues to diminish. Of course, that's one of the reasons you're having these videotapes,
yeah,
to try to capture some of those thoughts.
Yep.
But you had the Bernard Bogars, who was a very active faculty person, taught economics. I think he was very instrumental in organizing the faculty council, and I had him as a professor, and he was alive.
Yeah.
But he also kept you awake, too.
Yeah.
His tests were hard. And I can't remember the name of all the professors, but all of them, I think, were just top-notch.
Yeah.
And I believe the ones that I support today are equally as qualified.
Now, since you've been here as a student, and you came back and you've taught, and you've been in administration and in purchasing, how have you seen IUPUI's identity evolve and change over the years?
Well, we started out, we didn't really know who we were. I mean, even the newspapers didn't know what to call us.
Yeah.
And it was Indiana University, hyphen Purdue University, hyphen Indianapolis, and then all kinds of versions. And then somewhere along the line, they settled on IUPUI, and that began to resonate until they started to say ooey
pooey. Yep. That still hasn't died out.
Yeah,
completely.
That hasn't died out completely. But now it's just kind of like an old memory.
Yeah.
But we didn't know who we were. We knew we were IUPUI, but we didn't know the force or the magnitude of who we were. We were just going to college. We were going to school, and we were trying to make a living and get through it. And we didn't have very many organized activities at all. I mean, along the line came a basketball team, the Metros, now the Jaguars, but you just didn't know. You didn't have something to go rally around. We didn't have a wishing well or a fountain or anything like that, or a bell tower.
Yeah.
We didn't have any of those things.
A student center.
We didn't have a student center. No. So you go hang out in the basement of Cavanaugh Hall or the basement of the library, and you see another 150 students around you, no empty seats, and everybody's got their books cracked, because that was what they needed to do.
Yep.
They weren't there saying, we're going to have an organized dance tonight.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have them. Just didn't have them. Today, it's amazing. We've got so much pride in who we are as a campus. We have come so far, growing so large. We're not to the point where we're losing our identity. We're still growing, we're still thriving, and people are very accepting and recognizing that IUPUI is a force to be reckoned with. And as I travel, you know, I say IUPUI to people, and I still get this fuzzy little look on their face. And then I say, well, that's IU, Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. And the bulb goes off. Yep. I've heard of you.
Yep.
I've heard of you. I know who you are. You're that urban campus in Indianapolis. And so then you get this sense of pride. And I was at a little side story. I was at Chicago at a quarterly business meeting of the National Minority Supplier Development Conference. And a new president of the national conference was just elected. And the previous president had been there 23 years. So the new president was introduced at this conference just on July 27th. So she gets up, and I had not met her. And the other representatives from Indiana, one of them had met her, but she gets up and she says, I'm a Hoosier. I'm from Indianapolis. I went to IUPUI.
Oh, wow.
So that's the pride.
Yeah.
And, you know, others in the room knew who IUPUI was because they knew me.
Yeah.
Because I'm a member of the organization. But that shows how far we've come.
Yeah, it does. It really
does.
So
I thought that was really good. That's just 10 days ago.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because now as our numbers go up, we have more alumni, and you end up spreading out, and the name
goes
up. Well,
we kind of have more alumni.
Yeah.
Kind of have more alumni.
Yeah.
They're not IUPUI alumni.
Yeah, it's true.
you know, you get an IU degree.
Yeah, my degree will say IU on it.
That's right. But you're an IU alumni.
But I'm a Jaguar.
You're a Jaguar.
I'm a Jaguar, yeah.
And you'll be solicited by our alumni office.
Yep.
One of the things that I know campus administration wants to do is still try to reach out and get more connections with the students, former staff, to continue to build up the support. You know, when you have a fledgling campus, as we are, only 42 years old, your base is not very large because you haven't had an opportunity to graduate.
Yeah.
The hundreds of thousands, like Bloomington or Purdue.
Yeah, I went to Purdue for undergrad, and I see Purdue graduates everywhere, but I don't run into as many IUPUI. But
right, but those of us who have gone to IUPUI, have graduated from IUPUI, are IUPUI.
Yep.
Even though it's not on our diploma.
Now you said today that the campus is sort of becoming more centralized with Bloomington and the other regional campuses. So.
Well, I'm saying
in purchasing.
With
right?
purchasing.
Yeah.
Right, and that's based upon economics, that we're in tough financial times right now.
Yeah.
It's hard to raise funds through the foundation. It's hard to get government grants. It's hard to get state monies to build a building or even support administration. You know, we're going on our second year without pay raises.
Well.
And our budgets have just been slashed. And so you get to a point, gosh, I got distracted.
Oh, that's okay.
I lost my train of thought. Oh, centralized.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the thoughts was we will centralize some functions where it makes sense. Accounting, accounts payable, purchasing. We don't know what others might still be done, but we think there'll be a couple more, whether it be centralized and there'll be an advantage to reduce cost. Not necessarily through reducing the number of people who are working, but to, in our case in purchasing, to more focus on aggregate spend, to where when we're combined together, as we say with IU and Purdue, you know, we're the better of the two.
Yeah.
IUPUI. And so that's kind of what we're talking about with the purchasing departments. I felt kind of different about that. But I also recognize that's what it is. And it doesn't mean I'm any less dedicated to my job or to my customers. But it's changed. Probably it'll change back again sometime in the future. But as it was 39 years ago, excuse me, my anniversary date is 36 years as an administrator.
Okay.
So 36 years ago, we were very much tied to Bloomington. It took this long before it swung. It might take another 36 years before it goes back.
Well, as you look back at your long career at IUPUI, what would you say makes you most proud?
I think I'm most proud of the fact that I was able to be a part of something that was growing and will continue to grow, and I was able to help it. I was able to help with, participate with, like helping to remodel some buildings or helping with some programs or helping a faculty member get something going or whatever. A lot of behind the scenes things, but it helped them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a doctor, the urban life and science, the geology, geography people, I can't even think of her name right now, helped them get their canoes, helped them get their vehicles. You know, you help student services to hold a barbecue or something by helping them set up accounts and things like that. It's just all of the little pieces come together to make the bigger quilt,
yeah,
which becomes IUPUI. So I feel like I've contributed in many, many small ways, and maybe a few times in a big way, but it's the little things. You may have heard the bells ringing if you were here.
Mm-hmm.
We've waited all these years. We now have bells in our bell tower, and that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
But I've worked a long time. It took us a year and a half to get that accomplished. But those are the things that I remember. And that bell, the commemorative bell, which I was able to have forged, and that was through my initiative. And all the schools are listed on that commemorative bell. You might have seen it in the campus center. We had it on display. Well, at any rate, that bell was hung on Monday. Inside that bell is my name with a little scripto or, indelible marker.
Mm-hmm.
I and 50 others signed the inside of that bell. It will be there. Bells will last 400 years. If that building doesn't fall down, they'll probably still be able to see that.
Wow. It'll
be protected. That's one of the marks that you leave. That's always hidden. But I think a lot of the things I've done are hidden. My name doesn't appear here or there. It does on purchase orders.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't appear on the side of the wall as a donor. You know, I do donate money, but it doesn't appear that the Mel and Brand Simon Cancer Center. It's the little things. And I still hear from retirees. And the reason I hear from retirees is because I've had the same phone number for my whole career. We do 5 digits to dial locally.
Mm-hmm.
I've had the same phone number all this time. So retirees, they think of purchasing, they think of that number, and they call Halter, and it's 47746, and that's the number they call. So I may even have a retired staff person who was a janitor who called. In fact, I got a letter from the son of a housekeeping person who was a manager, who the housekeeping person would stay in touch with me. The son sent me a letter and said he died, but that's because they went through and found all that. And so you go to a lot of funerals, but it's that connection, it's the people.
Yeah.
And I hopefully have another 5 years before I retire, but what happens then between now and then?
Yeah.
About at the end.
Well, yeah, we're at the very, very end.
We're at the very end
well,
of tape, so
I'm sorry.
We'll wrap it up here. But is there anything that you would like to add here at the very end?
Oh,
can just keep the audio going.
I don't know. I guess did we cover most of the topics? I don't know if there's anything that I left out. I would say this: we've been extremely fortunate. As a campus, we've only had 4 chancellors. I've been fortunate enough to know all 4. And each chancellor, in my opinion, has been better than the previous one. I mean, it's like they've all grown. It's like as the campus grew, the chancellors grew, and each one took it to the next level. And that's a very good thing. So we didn't have somebody come in who took us back.
Yeah.
And the vision for IUPUI is still there, still to be the best urban university in the country. And I believe that we are. I believe that we are. And if we aren't, we're that close to it. So, and to have been a part of it, to me, has been very, very rewarding. And
yeah.
I appreciate it. I feel lucky to have been here and to be able to come to work and do my job.
Well, thank you. I feel lucky to have been able to talk to you today, so thank you for coming in.
I'm glad we had the opportunity.